This is another iRaw podcast.
We're trying to get to the point where animals are transformed from object to subject. And it shouldn't be difficult.
In this episode, I speak to Leslie Bisgold about the idea of animals as legal subjects. Leslie Bisgold is an adjunct professor at the University of Toronto who wrote the textbook, An Introduction to Animals and the Law. Leslie was also the first person in Canada to open up a legal firm that focused entirely on animal rights law. Currently, she works as a barrister at the Legal Aid Ontario Clinical Resource Office, where she assists caseworkers with complex appeals.
Well, firstly, hello and thank you for joining us, me and us today.
Delighted to be here.
Why don't we start off with you giving us a little bit of a sense of how you are involved in the animal world, animal studies world, but I think you're also involved in a more professional sense as well.
Yeah, I got involved in the animal world when I was a child because I became aware of some of the ways in which we hurt animals and got involved with advocacy organizations where I learned more and more. And then I grew up and started studying law and was volunteering with organizations who suddenly had all sorts of legal problems. And I started to realize that there was a need for a lawyer to specialize in this area. So I started a practice doing exclusively animal rights law for about 10 years.
You were the first in the country, right?
I was the first in the country. I am not a business person. I went broke. I burned out. And I learned a lot of lessons along the way. So I'm now a really good resource for other people who want to do it properly. So I switched over my full-time job to human rights and poverty law.
Okay.
But you can't unsee these things once you see them. So,
so I
keep a strong interest in the field. I teach a course at the law school at University of Toronto. I've written a textbook, and I'm on the board of directors of a group called ZooCheck Canada, which does wildlife issues. So, I've got my finger in a lot of pockets of the movement still.
So, when you say that you've got your hand in a lot of pockets and that you found an interest in animal studies early on.
That's a terrible thing for a lawyer to say.
Hand in
a lot of pockets.
Okay, let's rephrase it. You are interested in many, many facets of animals and researching animals, and then you say that there are several things that you cannot unsee. What are some of these, like, what are we really talking about here when you say what, I mean, you don't have to get, oh, you can. What do you mean when there are things you cannot unsee? For you, what was a turning point?
Well, the turning point for me definitely was a picture that I saw as a child of a raccoon whose leg was caught in a steel jaw leg hold trap. And that led me to learn about the fur industry.
Mm.
And so once you start to learn these things, you see pictures of coyotes who, you know, live in tiny steel cages, freezing cold, waiting to be anally electrocuted so that they can become fur trim. I worked a lot of years on the seal hunt, so I've seen footage of that. I hope all Canadians have seen the footage of undercover footage from some of the agriculture facilities showing what happens to the animals who are raised to become our food.
Yeah.
These are images you can never get over, and you can't walk away once you've seen them. You got to do something.
And there might be some cognitive dissonance that people are, like I know for myself, the interest in animals was kind of a struggle with myself, and then there was a moment of almost clarity, I think, where I couldn't convince myself otherwise anymore, and it was almost a moment of reckoning. But yeah, it's really just, it's always interesting to find out how people found themselves on these different paths. What's also interesting about the conversation with you is my first episode was with Will, and we started off the conversation with me saying, but you're not a lawyer. What do you do? Do you stand in a court you know, telling people what to do. And he was very quick to say, that's litigation. Mm-hmm. And I think that this provides quite an interesting juxtaposition where Will thinks about ideas of law and animal rights, but you have stood in the courtrooms and you've fought some cases that involve animals directly. Is that correct?
Yes and no. So I would say I'm an advocate for animal rights, and at the same time I would say there's no such thing as animal rights mm-hmm. in law. You know, morally we may think there is such a thing, we may aspire to it legally, but in our legal system, animals are property. So to litigate animals in court is a tricky and an interesting issue, because it turned out that my practice, even though I called it an animal rights practice, turned out to be a human rights practice. Because humans could get to court, and so I fought for the right of humans who cared about animals not to have to hurt them or to act on their feelings. So, for example, I mentioned the seal hunt a minute ago. I acted for individuals who wanted to observe the seal hunt, and the federal government made it incredibly difficult for them to do that. It required them to have a license. It made the license not valid long enough for them to go out and find the hunt and actually do any observation. Mm-hmm. It put all sorts of impediments on the license to really frustrate the use of it. I acted for students who didn't want to have to do dissection or vivisection to get course credit. There is now in the animal world, the animal law world, an explosion of interest, lots of people getting involved, and I think a divergence of opinion as to getting animals themselves into court and what we can and should be doing now.
So that's so interesting on so many levels, because the idea of students still getting credit that don't want to hurt animals, I think that must be a really terrifying place for a student to be, where they, you know, the industry is telling you that this is the way it's done and if you want to do this. So it's not just a legal issue, but a social issue there for them too.
Absolutely. Not just the industry, your peers. Mm. Imagine being even a child. Like, university is hard enough, but a child putting up their hand, I don't want to do this. I mean, it takes a lot of courage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think this takes us quite well into the focus of today's podcast, in talking about the idea of legal subjects. So you're saying that you were in courtrooms inadvertently trying to aid animals, but through the ideas of human rights. So human right to observe, human right to object. I don't know if that's a right. I'm not a lawyer, so feel free to... But there are no... So you say animals are property, and therefore they have no rights. So where does the idea of legal subject come in then?
I would say, there may be different answers depending on who you ask, but in my opinion, I would say that's what we're striving for in the animal rights law movement. We're trying to get to the point where animals are transformed from object to subject. And it shouldn't be difficult. Legally, we have a logical path, a coherent path. Corporations are legal persons who easily can have their interests recognized in court. We have a very simple system that allows for corporations to have representatives who speak on their behalf. Those are inanimate constructs. We have infants. We have a mechanism by which infants' interests can be represented in court. Surely there's a way for animals. What's stopping us is not any the lack of legal mechanism, but the lack of human will. Mm-hmm. So we, by which I mean, you know, all of us broadly as a society, we care about animals in some ways, but we're always very cautious about giving them too much protection in law, because in the back of our minds we understand the implications. If I give too many rights to my dog, that has implications for my steak, mm-hmm. and I want my steak. That's where our society is stuck, and that's why we haven't been able to move animals from object to subject just yet.
So maybe to come back a bit, what is a legal subject?
So a legal subject, I think the term really refers to someone who is entitled to participate in the legal system, as opposed to having things done to her. So my mug that I'm holding now is an object. My companion animal is an object too, though. I can do whatever I want to my object, subject to some constraints, which may be an area you want to move into. But An object is something you act upon. A subject has interests that the law respects and will protect.
So when a business or an organization is a legal subject, that means that the law is not considering the individuals necessarily in that business, but they're considering the business as an entity that has its own almost life, that has a life of its own that's worth considering.
Exactly. They might do both. In corporate law, there is, you know, there's sometimes a dispute between the corporation itself and some of the individuals who are shareholders or play other roles. That's the dispute in corporate law. But yes, the point is exactly that a corporation is a legal subject, has interests that the law recognizes and will protect.
And those interests are primarily economic interests?
When it comes to corporations, I would say yes. Mm. But a municipality is a certain kind of corporation, and because municipalities don't exist in the Constitution, they only exist because provincial law creates them. So they're creatures of statute, the same way a corporation is. Statutes set up the rules by which we can have these corporations. So a municipality, let's say, their interests aren't all economic. They have other interests.
Yes.
So
an organization is a legal subject because it has interests in and of itself. Mm-hmm. A municipality is also one, but animals are not.
Correct.
Okay. Are there any countries in which animals are considered legal subjects, or is this just around the world doesn't exist?
So it's an academic question in the sense that that term is really only used in academic discussions about what's happening in law.
Okay.
On the ground, if we want to see what's really happening to animals, we might be more interested in asking ourselves, like, does the law anywhere recognize the rights of animals? And I would argue no. I would say there are some jurisdictions that express their interest in protecting animals a little bit better than others. But protecting animals is very different than empowering animals to express their interests. So what I mean by that is we have animal welfare legislation all across Canada, all across the United States, most Western jurisdictions, Eastern ones as well. I'm just not as familiar with how those legal systems work. So we have laws that say, you know, you can't unnecessarily cause pain and suffering to an animal.
Mm.
So that superficially seems really good, but there's all sorts of limitations. First of all, those laws don't empower the animal to do anything. The animal can't stop you from hurting them. The animal can't bring a legal action to prevent you from taking steps that are going to hurt her. The animal can only be hurt. And then if a human sees the event, is willing to testify...
So it's reactive. You know, yeah.
It's reactive and it's passive. It's from the animal's perspective, right? And then there's all sorts of qualifications built into that law. So it's not that you can't cause any pain and suffering to an animal. You can't cause unnecessary pain and suffering to an animal. So that means that some pain and suffering is necessary.
Mm.
In other words, we've written ourselves permission to hurt animals whenever we want to. So long as there's a purpose, and it's not just gratuitous, it's probably okay to hurt animals in most cases.
So
that's not a legal right. So that's why they're legal objects.
They're objects, and in essence, we're given rein to do to them as we please, as long as... as humans, we think it is a necessary hurt. Now, that seems incredibly subjective, depending on different cultural practices, class practices, different places. That seems to become more of a battle between people and how people think animals should be used than how animals themselves would like to live. And I guess...
You've hit on another layer of complication, absolutely. Absolutely, because we have had instances, you know, in Canada, in the United States, and elsewhere, where certain cultural practices are objected to in respect of animals. And then there have been objections. Why are you choosing this particular cultural practice when, you know, the broader practice is so much worse? And why are you picking this one? And is race an issue or culture an issue? And so there's layers of complication, absolutely.
And you know, another layer is not only the complexity, I think, between people themselves and how they relate to animals, but also responses to animals or relations with animals. I had a really complicated conversation with my husband on the way here, where we were speaking about ecology and, you know, this idea of, you know, in quotations, invasive species, and how some might see, you know, the eradication, again, very like forceful language, of certain species as being necessary in order to protect others. So there's kind of this built-in idea of paternalism, where I think some would argue we have to have terms like necessary and unnecessary, because how would we manage, you know, those conflicts between two different animals? How do we get to decide that if all the animals have equal rights?
Exactly. So that's exactly the premise most people come from, which is an assumed position of superiority, an assumed position of management. We should and we can manage animal populations, and all of it to whatever end we think is the right one. It's all entirely subjective human values with a hierarchy with us on top.
Yeah.
And if that's how you want to live, then, you know, then sure, you've got it. Here's your system. It's perfectly designed for you. But now that we live in a time where our biological kinship with animals is more obvious than ever, and every day we're only learning more details about it, lots of people, like a new generation is rising that is finding this unacceptable and questioning those premises. You know, who am I to decide? Why are we, the species who are, you know, systemically destroying the biological basis of our own existence, why are we the ones who think we have the authority to decide how it should all work? And even if we thought we did have the authority, what evidence is there that we even know how?
That we can, yeah.
We don't know how to do this. We can't manage ourselves. How can we manage all the others?
So how would creating, maybe if animals were given more, so you say they don't, the word legal subjects doesn't exist within the law per se, but that variety of rights or actions create the idea of legal subjects.
I mean that like in terms of, I shouldn't say it doesn't exist in law as much as like litigation, going to court, trying to advance the interests of animals. The reference to legal subject versus legal object is a bit of an academic designation.
Okay.
When you get more on the ground and you're in court litigating a particular issue, you might not use those terms. It might be a little bit different. It might be that you're talking about, you know, interpreting the law that I just described to you. Like how do we get to court to talk about animals' interests, right? So maybe somebody has caused unnecessary pain and suffering to an animal.
Mm.
So then we'd be in court talking about the interpretation of that term and if that's what happened in the particular case.
And then is it additive? So now you've had an argument about what constitutes as necessary or unnecessary. Is it then this now becomes... I know there's a legal word for it, that sets a precedent. Is that so? Is it just precedent upon precedent that eventually a kind of definition of what constitutes necessary or unnecessary comes to be?
That's the idea. That's the idea. That's how common law is supposed to work, that we interpret these things and then that becomes the perspective by which other courts are bound. Sorry.
Nope.
That's how our law develops. Now, human creativity is such that, you know, judges are often able to find ways to distinguish a particular case if they don't want to apply that principle in the context before them. Both ways, you know. Creative judges who see something terrible happening to an animal and don't think they have the precedence there might be able to interpret them in a creative way to take the law in the next to the next step in that direction. And more conservative judges who don't want the law to evolve too broadly can find creative ways to continue to restrain it. So that's the strength and the weakness of the common law system, that it's subject to the interpretation of a human being.
And so I think then that just kind of, does the law come before the change in the shift of human thinking or social thought around it versus people manifesting changes in how these things are interpreted? But you're suggesting earlier on that there are welfare laws and that these are protection, but also that there is something deficient, some sort of laws that are missing. Are those, what are those?
Well,
laws that are missing is an interesting way to put it. So what I would say is pretty much all the laws that are on the books now that purport to restrain the harm we cause to animals all have that qualified language. So whether they prohibit unnecessary suffering, undue suffering, prolonged suffering, they're all qualified in such a way as to tell us it's okay to hurt the animal subject to these limitations, whatever they may be. But the premise is it's okay to do it so long as you can bring us the right context. So that necessarily places us in a dominant position. We are placing ourselves in a dominant position over them. We are making ourselves the subjects and them the objects. Mm-hmm. We can do what we want subject to whatever limitations there may be. A different approach would see animals differently, would not refer to them as things, would not grant license to hurt them. There's a lot of dispute as to, you know, what these better laws might look like. But laws that appoint guardians for animals, you know, who can speak for them, who can represent their interests in a court proceeding, laws recognizing their personhood, are in great debate right now, because we see in places, for example, in the United States, there's been a famous series of cases trying to establish personhood on behalf of the captive chimpanzees mm-hmm. of New York, and it got interesting for a while, ultimately failed, as I think was probably expected, and these were habeas corpus applications. So habeas corpus is an ancient legal writ, which still exists today, where an individual who is being held, usually like imprisoned by the state, calls upon the state to justify that
their imprisonment.
And so it's very familiar to us in the human context. We still use it in the criminal law context all the time or in other ways. But I thought it was such a phenomenally interesting idea when people started applying it to animals, to captive animals. Hey, state, justify my captivity. What are the principles upon which you justify keeping me here? And you have to be a legal person to be able to exercise that right.
Yes.
So it didn't work out yet in the United States. The Non-Human Rights Project wasn't able to succeed with chimpanzees. They're trying new cases with elephants. But there are places in South America where the courts have said that. They have granted habeas corpus applications to great apes. And so does that change everything overnight? Of course not. You know, they still eat animals. They still experiment on animals. Like, it's a very slow process. But every little bit forward, I think, makes a difference, because it helps to normalize the idea that animals are our kin. It helps to normalize the idea that they have to be treated with respect, that we have to consider the implications of our actions on them when we take those actions.
Yeah, some might argue, though, that that's just another form of creating different concentric circles, that we consider these few, but when the vast majority lie outside of our consideration, and largely invisible, you know, there are a lot of, and I think it's, you know, it's wonderful. I tend to agree with you. I think that minds change in increments, not in huge swaths. I think incrementally, bit by bit. But I do see the concern with just the idea of creating a different divide. So now we've included more, which is great for you know, the chimps and the apes that are no longer being harmed. It's definitely a win for them. But then do people just become complacent now and like, okay, great, we've won? Or is it more powerful because a precedent has been set, and now once that ball starts to roll, and maybe, now my mind is going, but maybe it just strategically makes sense to choose species that capture people's hearts. It's really hard.
It's so hard, and you've hit it right on the head. I mean, and I think I've heard both perspectives well articulated. I think there's merit to both, and it's very hard to know. And so one thing I think is important in this work is to try to remain humble and think, you know, never persuade yourself you've got the answer, because it's never clear what the answer is. Mm-hmm. So I think both your points are valid. And I see the same problem in the human world, by the way, right? In human rights, we have the same issue with those who are included and those who are excluded.
Yeah.
And different groups who have succeeded over time in expanding those. Most recently, we're talking about gender identity and gender expression, but it's still new in many places. It's still rejected. So is that the best approach in the human world? I'm not sure. You know, maybe we should have all been included at the outset. That would have been great, but we weren't. So how do we fix it? I think there's no clear answer. You know, human behavior, human society is so complex that to me the question is always, like, to make this argument, do I have to say anything that undermines the essential argument? You know, can I make this argument without insulting the principle that I'm trying to advance?
Yes.
Even if it doesn't go far enough, even if I wish it would do more, you know, that's, I think, at least a first step. That's a test. And then, you know, and then I like to just talk about ideas with as many people as possible, get as much input, and think about the implications as much as you can. And then at some point, you got to take a shot.
Yeah, and I think if history is ever anything to go by, the idea, at least the premise, I think, of constant inclusion, you know, it has some, at least in terms of how it's structured, how we speak about it, it assumes that there's some sort of center to which everything else is included and that center is perfect. And I think by showing how, you know, fallible a lot of our human relations are and a lot of our human laws are, I mean, they're all human, but at least the laws. But I think that through practice, everyday practice and a sort of consciousness raising, that these being even considered in the legal system now is an indicator of things having changed. It wasn't too long ago that animals were once in courtrooms, and that's an interesting, I've never really read any cases or anything, but it's an interesting idea to think of, because I wonder if you were trying an animal for something it had done wrong, is that closer to some sort of idea of personhood or legal subject than what we currently have now, where they're completely invisible and not held responsible or considered in any way?
So you're referring to the European animal trials?
Yeah.
So, I mean, most people have no idea that that ever happened. And it's such an interesting phenomenon in this context, because you're right. I mean, animals were charged. They went to court. They got legal aid. they had legal defenses. They were acquitted. They won on appeal. It's such an interesting phenomenon. It lasted over 1,000 years.
1,000 years.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so much to say on that topic. But essentially, the trials divided into two sorts of areas. There were like ecclesiastical trials and then more secular trials. But it's hard to really make the case that the secular trials were not also operating under, you know, the pressure of religious ideas. But it tended to be that individual animals, most often pigs, were charged in the secular context for having murdered a child or the havoc that they caused as individuals. And then the ecclesiastical trials were more for insects.
What, really?
Swarms of insects, termites who came and destroyed a monastery. And their punishment upon conviction would be excommunication.
What?
So what is going on? I mean, it is such an area of study. Like, I mean, how can you excommunicate insects if they weren't communicated in the first place? Are we now is the church arguing that insects have souls? You know.
Well, I suppose it would have been based on the idea that humans brought it, I don't know, did they bring it upon themselves because they broke a law or a rule of sorts, like an ordained idea? That is fascinating.
So fascinating. I mean, we could go on this all day, so I won't get too into it, except to say there are different theories about what was really going on here. Like, were these plays, essentially, that were being put on for society to, you know, using animals as actors to demonstrate, you know, the rules of law in action, or were there more? I mean, they went pretty far, and, you know, animals were attributed a sort of agency in those trials that we've never seen attribute to them since.
Well, at least their actions were being given thought, like they were doing, and maybe, you know, being brought to trial. It seems ludicrous on one end, but then in this conversation here and trying to, like, think of animals as subjects, I think just the imagery of that, of an animal standing in a courtroom, it just raises so many questions straight off the bat, not just in terms of thinking of how afraid the animal would be to be in that space, and, you know, you start to bring in these ideas of the rational subject, and can they be considered a subject of the law if they're not rational beings, because that's how we define ourselves. But I do think that it's also an interesting idea because they were being held accountable for action in a community, but whether their interests were necessarily being considered, what they needed in order to be part of that community is possibly a different question.
Exactly. And in criminal law, there's two elements to the offense. There's did you commit the act, but also did you have the criminal intent?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to suggest that an animal might have had the intent to commit this act goes to exactly what you were just talking about. I mean, did they have that capacity to think and understand? Are we saying animals are rational?
Well, because you can't hold both ends of this pole. You can't say that they had the intent to harm X or steal your... Chances are they had every intention of stealing your potatoes and your carrots.
Right.
I don't doubt, you know, they know what they're doing.
Did they know they were stealing them? Or did they
exactly.
Just,
the idea know, of
yeah,
theft... were they sneaking around? Were they skulking? Or was it just there's a potato and I'm going to take it? It's such an interesting idea to,
mm-hmm.
to unpack.
So much, yeah.
Coming back to the monkeys, you said there were monkeys in New York, right?
Chimps. Yeah.
What happened with that? So you said it wasn't successful. Was it just thrown out because they aren't seen as subjects, or
there were several cases because there were several captive chimpanzees around the state, gas stations, people's homes. I mean, the most horrific conditions you can imagine.
So these aren't chimps in a zoo.
These are captive chimps in a variety of different circumstances. And I forget if there was a zoo. They were mostly owned by individuals.
Wow.
I mean, that too is a whole other conversation. How many individuals think it's interesting to keep exotic animals as pets? Even Ontario is known as the Wild West in the world of exotic animals because
really?
Of how easy it is to get yourself a pet tiger or a pet lion.
Really?
People who keep them in the basement. Yeah.
There are pet tigers and lions in Ontario?
Yes, there are. And it would be no problem to get you one in several days.
And it's legal?
Well, no, it's not. It depends. like all big legal questions, the answer is the same. It depends. So sometimes there are municipal bylaws that prohibit keeping exotic animals. Sometimes CITES, the international treaty that deals with the international trade in wildlife, sometimes it's relevant. So it may or may not be legal, but... it's definitely often secret, and that's the biggest part of it, is that...
Well, it says something if you feel the need to have a practice that's underground.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And it says all sorts of things. Why do you need a basement full of big, dangerous cats? I don't know. Yeah, there's all sorts of problems it reveals, I think.
I think I read not too long ago, I think it's Rosemary Collard's work in UBC, and she does work on... the trade of animals, and I think it was in her dissertation where she spoke about the US being the biggest importer of wildlife, and it's not kind of the discourse that you actually get sold when you hear about all of these stories of wild animals being killed for a variety of reasons or being harmed in international trade. So I'm from South Africa, and this comes up often in terms of rhinos. So rhinos are currently in a state of rhinoceroses. We in South Africa, rhinos are shorthand, and I'm learning that that's not necessarily understandable.
No, we should know what a rhino is. Yeah,
yeah. Just in case. So people are reacting, I think rightfully so, doing everything they can to protect these animals. Maybe not legally, so maybe that's where the question comes in. But in terms of setting up sanctuaries and conservations, there are some places in which rhinos are literally being followed and protected 24 hours a day. The investment in resources in terms of protecting them as a charismatic species, but just as beautiful, wonderful animals. And the story we are told is that this is primarily for Chinese and Vietnamese markets, which I'm sure is very much, you know, I'm sure it's based on facts and reasoning. But we're not really told the other stories of where trade is happening, that tigers are being sold to the U.S. It just doesn't seem to be as apparent that the U.S. is bringing in Burmese pythons and tigers, and it's just an interesting...
Absolutely. It's easy. Let's blame a foreigner, right? What about pharmaceutical companies that are bringing them in to be used in research? You know, absolutely, the United States and Canada and Europe.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've never actually done any work on, you know, animals in captivity and the kinds of, no animals have any rights, but I suppose that if there was ever an animal that had like a claim to why am I here, justify me being here, yet, because the extent of the experimentation is just incredible, the types of things that animals have to go through, from, like you mentioned, electrocution of foxes in the fur industry, but I think also these animals get electrocuted not once, not twice, multiple times, several times. I think in one of your talks spoke about dogs being burned.
Absolutely. Pigs. I mean, burn studies, pain studies, maternal deprivation studies, sensory deafferentation studies, like smoking studies still.
That seems crazy. I think, yeah. Have we not got enough evidence that smoking's not great for you?
Yeah, it's shaken baby syndrome.
So bad.
And research in many ways, like, people have stopped talking about animals in research, I think, because finally we are starting to talk about animals in agriculture, which is fantastic. And what I keep hearing now is everybody saying statistically, no other animals are relevant. In other words, the overwhelming, we're talking billions of animals in the agriculture industry.
Yeah.
So statistically, all the other animals slip away. But what's happening to all those other animals is horrific. And when we think about animals in science, they're there deliberately to be hurt. And even in agriculture, we can, you know, pretend that we're making sincere efforts at not really hurting them, even though we bring them into existence, you know, explicitly for the purpose of killing and dismembering and consuming them. So it's hard to make that case there, although people do make it and buy it. But in research, you know, it's just straight out, I sure wouldn't want to do it to myself, so let's find somebody else to do this experiment on.
But this is exactly where someone would also step forward and say, this is a trickier one than food, because food, the reasoning seems vapid almost. I want to eat this, even though there are multitudes of alternatives, I want to eat this because it's delicious. And then when you kind of follow that argument through a bit further, then you think, okay, torture and life over delicious, the scales don't quite seem to be on par. So I do find that when I have these types of conversations or arguments with people, often it comes down to medical research. We need it. Like, this is a fundamental need. We need to figure out how to solve Alzheimer's. We need to figure out how to, you know, cure cancer. These are really important things that are killing and hurting humans. So that's justified. Hurting these animals is justified. And you would argue against that?
Well, it's a common refrain. I think you're right. When it comes to research, you know, everybody wants to find the cure for cancer. Everybody wants to solve all these problems. And we say we can't leave any stone unturned. But that's not true, because the best models for disease in the human body are humans.
Mm.
And we have made a very deliberate decision, at least in most places. Of course, there are horrific examples of times when that's not the case, and we are all mortified by that. But in general, it's understood that we don't take unconsenting human beings and subject them to experiments in the interest of other human beings. We don't treat human beings as the means to another's end.
Mm-hmm.
So even though we do want to find the cure for these diseases, we have said that we will leave that stone unturned, because some things are more important than a cure to disease, which is the rules of a healthy society, the rights that individuals have to their own bodies. We're not willing to compromise those rights. The interest of one human being over the interest of the many who will be saved by the cure to cancer, right? We value the rights of every individual. Now, what happens when we say, okay, we're going to, instead of using humans, we're going to switch over to animals? Why is there suddenly the disconnect? When we keep in mind that the only reason we would use animals in experiments is if they are sufficiently similar to us that the results of those experiments are going to be meaningful.
Yeah.
If they're so much like us, then where does this justification come from?
And I suppose also depending on the animal and the question that's being asked, I think that argument goes either way, because sometimes the argument has been made, yes, they're so much like us, so we need to use them for this experiment. Other times, entire years of experimentation have happened on animals for them to get a drug approved, only to find that as soon as that drug is taken by the humans that it's intended for, it doesn't work that way. Which then raises, you know, another challenge to, is this really the best way to achieve that? And isn't there also that, is it like the 60-40 rule or something? I forget what it is, where I think if 40% of the animals die, then it's considered too, like, lethal or something. Like, there's...
I wonder if you might be thinking of the LD50 test?
Yes, that's probably...
So that is a very old and absolutely disproved, is not the right word, I can't find words today. It's a test that has been proven to be unscientific.
I think disproved sounds just fine.
But it's still used across North America. It's the lethal dose 50 test, where... a toxic substance is force-fed to a group of animals, and we wait and watch to see what level of toxicity has to be reached before half of those animals die. And when you die of toxicity poisoning, you don't just close your eyes and fall asleep. You know, it's an agonizing, horrific death. And it's a very blunt scientific experiment. It's very old. It's been proven to be ineffective because it's so blunt. And it's still done all the time. It's still all, just like the Dreyse test. That's another one that dates from the same time. Dreyse test is usually performed on albino rabbits because their eyes don't tear. So they're restrained and their eyes are held open and toxic substances are poured in their eyes. So we can watch them go blind and see all the harm that these substances cause. And we have such better methods now. But our systems are set up in this way. It's always been done this way. There's big money in this way and lots of interests to be protected. And these absolutely horrific tests persist.
Yeah, and it seems... So if we were to consider the rabbit in that story as having its own interests, if we were to start the whole question as you, as a being that has interest, would this be in your interest? Is this drug that we're even testing for helpful for you? And even if it were, would this treatment be for you?
And is it okay to do this? Because you've hit on something, because the industry will sometimes do experiments for animals. You know, they'll test the efficacy of drugs for human companions or for farm animals. And use that defense, right? Oh, well, we're doing it for the benefit of animals. But other animals, right? Not this one. You know, don't experiment on me for the benefit of other humans. I certainly wouldn't go for that. So why is it okay to benefit on one animal for the benefit of others? At some point, you are crossing a line where you're granting yourself permission to objectify that other. And so you're going to have to articulate a principled basis to justify that. And I've yet to hear one.
So this takes us back to the question that I've asked, that we, the monkeys, what did the court, the chimps, what did the court, what did the, because the principal basis, because you had said that they were being asked to justify why they were being kept, and then it fell apart. Did they ever have to justify?
There was one case, I'm not as up to speed as I should be on them, there was one case where the application was initially granted, but then failed in the end.
Okay.
So, but there was some of the reasoning that the judges used was very sympathetic. Like, you know, I'd like to go here, but I really can't.
Mm.
And that's a good sign. You know, that's what courts say on their way to saying yes. You know, they say no, 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 until one day it doesn't seem quite so strange. And we expect them to say yes. You know, we see it in the human world. Marriage equality is a great example. It lost and lost and lost, and then the Supreme Court said yes, and it's seemed obvious ever since.
So what constrains a judge? Maybe this because someone outside of the legal system, it sounds like if a judge makes something, that judge gets to set the precedent. What constrains a judge? Why would a judge not just, if they felt the ethical impulse to say, you know what, this is wrong, you're right, the law is behind in this, I'm going to set the precedent now. What is the constraints on a judge?
Well, there's a few constraints. I guess the primary one is that the judges are human beings, and so they have the same constraints as everybody else in terms of concern about what their peers are going to say, concerns about what society is going to say, what's going to be the reaction, will I look like an idiot, concerns that they'll be overturned on appeal, right? You want to write a judgment that's going to be able to hold up and not seem silly on appeal and not just be ignored. So there's ego, there's social pressure, they're subject to all the same pressures that everybody else is. And they do have to try to operate within the generalities of the law, they just can't make it up out of the air. So they do have to have some principles to take them where they want to go.
But then are we not in a catch-22? If they can't make it out of thin air and there's no legal subjectivity for animals in this way, then is it not just an endless loop of there's no hope because this isn't a precedent, it doesn't exist, so there's no wiggle room for a judge to, you know, take that leap?
Some people certainly argue that. I would say that the common law, which is what we have, is designed specifically to be able to make slow bits of changes, to evolve carefully in accordance, you know, with our societal views. But judges' interpretation of the law is just one aspect of it. There's also the actual laws on the books that our legislators pass, and then the judges are interpreting those. So there is a debate in the legal world about where we should be putting our resources. Should we be focusing on the laws that are drafted, the actual statutes, and what we want them to say? Should we be focusing on how those statutes are interpreted?
Mm-hmm.
Should we be going to the legislators, who are politicians, who are responsive or not responsive to the public? Should we be going to judges who are responsive to these other, you know, sorts of pressures and who are, you know, trying to interpret the law in the way they think is right? So there's room, I think, everywhere. It's just a question of what creative approach we think might work.
And how could an everyday person, like me, who's not a lawyer, I'm not involved in the legal system, but I'm interested in these types of cases or ideas, you know, one, what could I do to, you know, help further the idea of animals being legal subjects? And two, if I wanted to learn more about the relationship between animals and the law, what would you suggest?
I think that you're asking me specifically about law, and I hear that, but I will just say in a general way, because of what we've just acknowledged about how slow, like, law is a social institution that can sometimes be grand, but is generally very proud of being slow and conservative and reflective and cautious. So most social change doesn't happen in the law, right? Mm-hmm. It gets reflected eventually in the law, but that's law telling us our society's already changed, mm-hmm. right? So another important tool that law can serve is to empower advocates to have discussion, to have democratic debate. So the seal hunt observers that I acted for example, were out there to collect information about what the seal hunt actually looks like, to take it to the public, to show them how different the real seal hunt looked from what the government was describing,
yeah.
So that we as a society could have a debate about what we wanted. And then all of that evidence persuaded Russia and other countries that were consuming these products to stop buying them. So we didn't even need law, you know, about animals. We just needed laws to empower people to collect information. So there's so many different ways in which law can be useful. But there's also so many different ways in which we as concerned citizens can be useful, which is to just make ourselves knowledgeable. You know, make ourselves... It's one thing to feel. A lot of people come to this area because they see a picture and they have a visceral reaction, and that's fair. That's fair. You see something horrible, you feel horrible, great. But now you've got to find some words to articulate what's wrong about that. And you can do that in any field, because I think that's how social change happens. Not when strangers are... Not that I oppose people protesting. I respect it. I did it myself. But it's different when a stranger holds up a sign telling you, you're bad, you know, than when your colleague says, hey, did you see that footage about how they anally electrocute those coyotes? You know, it's less threatening. It's less judgmental. It's, you know, so that's to me how society really changes, when we all start talking about this. So there's a role for everybody.
Yeah.
So to learn more about law, there's books.
No. Say it in, so.
You might have heard of books. You might have read a few while you're pursuing your PhD.
I'm pursuing PhD by podcast.
There's courses, there's websites. There's an organization in Canada now who works on animal legal issues called Animal Justice.
Animal Justice.
There's the Animal Legal Defense Fund in the United States. There's courses at universities across North America. So it's all out.
So it's gaining traction as a...
Oh, definitely. Like, just in a way I would have never believed 20 years ago what happened.
Wow. Well,
yeah.
that's promising. Even
yeah.
just the number of people, because there is something critical mass, more
Absolutely.
People seeing this as an area in which, you know, we've had relationships with animals forever. The fact that they aren't better integrated into our legal systems seems a bit strange, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to talk forever. I said the same thing to Will, and we just kept going because this is just interesting stuff.
Mm.
But before we start wrapping up, I asked if you would see if you have a quote or, you know, something from a book that you'd want to share. I said to Will as well that I'm busy trying this out to see how it goes. I think it offers some interesting points in terms of how you're thinking and maybe someone you want to give a nod to. So what do you have for us?
I do think it's a really interesting idea. I like that. And I'm a quote person myself because I hear things that I think are great, and I'm showing you now this book that I have where I collect some of these
it's
quotes.
It's so lovely. And
so,
she's got like handwritten bits in there in different colors and like cutouts from printouts. It's
just
awesome.
Yeah, well, I'm so
are those news
by
articles?
I subscribe to different websites. So I'll get like an email a day from the Liberty website, and some of them sound good and they're too long. I'm too lazy to write it, so I just print it.
That's very clever.
But the one that I thought was really maybe best describes my views in this area is from a Jewish religious scholar going back about 2,000 years whose name was Hillel. And he said, "What is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow. That is the whole law. All the rest is interpretation."
Wow. It really cuts to the heart of it.
It cuts to the heart of it. And then, of course, everything turns on who is my fellow.
And that's where social scientists come in.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I mean, the amount of work that's been done in terms of just disrupting this idea, this distinction between human and animal, it seems to be an infinite regression. Like, we're slowly running out of ideas. We're creative, yep, so are animals. We're rational. They've got fairly good rationales for why they do what they do, too. We have culture. Have you seen orcas? It becomes really hard to hold that justification, I think.
We are ever in pursuit of that. What is that one factor that's going to preserve our privilege? And it's me.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sitting and chatting with me today and for that great quote. Who did you say that's by?
He was I'm not religious myself, but he was a religious scholar going back like to the year 10.
Wow.
His name was Hillel, yeah. And... it's a famous quote of his. He was a respected scholar in the time, and still
today. Beautiful. Well, thank you. I'll include it up with the podcast. Have a wonderful day.
Well, thank you so much for the discussion. It's fantastic, your project you're embarked on, and it was really nice to be part of it.
Thank you.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's iRawPod.com.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples. The CFRC Podcast Network at podcast.cfrc.ca is brought to you by the generous support of the Queen's University Faculty of Engineering and Applied Sciences.